Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming and welcome to another International Manifesto Group webinar on Trump's aggression in Latin America, the return of the Monroe Doctrine, question mark. I'm Radhika Desai, the convener of the International Manifesto Group and the moderator for today's event. One might be forgiven for thinking that the world changed utterly on the 5th of November 2024 when Donald Trump was re-elected president. He has put nearly all parts of the world on a roller coaster with his promises and threats, none more so than the Americas. He threatened to make Canada the 51st state, to acquire Greenland, to take back the Panama Canal, to impose punishing tariffs on Mexico, and to step up the already ruinous war on drugs in that country, and to sanction any country buying Venezuelan oil, threatening to choke off the principal export of that heroic people, already beleaguered by decades of US and Western sanctions. It is no wonder that media and social media have been abuzz with talk of the reinvigoration of the Monroe Doctrine, originally proclaimed in 1823, declaring that the Western Hemisphere was the United States' sphere of influence. So what are we to make of it? Are we sort of turning the clock back and taking us all back to a late 19th century scenario? Certainly you'd think that if you listen to Trump and his lionization of figures like President McKinley. And undoubtedly Trump has already created much damage and destruction, not just by carrying out these threats, which are still in their preliminary phases of implementation, but just by making them. Undoubtedly, more damage and destruction are to come, largely to be inflicted on the weak. At the same time, it is not at all clear whether he will or can carry out these threats. That's what our panel discussion is going to be about today. And to start us off, I thought I would outline some of what I consider to be the key parameters of the discussion. While the Monroe Doctrine was said to have been originally proclaimed in 1823, so 202 years ago, its meaning and enforcement have been a movable feast over these two centuries. Originally proclaimed to exclude European powers from the Western Hemisphere, today it is directed towards none more than China, whose footprint, of course, on both the continents is growing every day. Originally taken to imply support for the independence of Latin American countries, if only because the United States did not have the military capacity to do much else, by the end of the 19th century, when it acquired that capacity, the doctrine began to be enforced and it spelled the beginning of the nefarious gunboat diplomacy for which the United States became famous, particularly vis-a-vis the Americas. And since then, the doctrine has threatened the independence de facto, if not de jure, of the same countries, or at least the weaker ones among them. The Monroe Doctrine emerges, so in its effective form from the late 19th century, it emerges from a time when new powers began challenging British industry and empire with their own industries and empire. The French had West Africa after losing North America. While hanging on to some territories in southern Africa, the Germans always eyed Eastern Europe. Japan had its East Asian co-prosperity sphere. The Americas were the United States' intended backyard, though its situation was peculiar. Having been detained by its project of internal colonialism, as its westward expansion is also called, and therefore arriving late in the imperial game, it had to be satisfied not by direct colonization, but with exerting control over a Western Hemisphere that was already composed of formerly independent states, usually quite capable of asserting their independence. So finally today, Trump's version of the Monroe Doctrine will be hampered by the United States' decreasing ability to impose its will, while those of China and Russia, powers that have been expanding the options of Latin American countries, have only been growing. Consider that in his first call with the Canadian Prime Minister, the new Canadian Prime Minister, Trump refrained from any allusions to the 51st state, indicated agreement to negotiate tariffs, and praised Canada and Carney, while Carney said that Trump respected Canadian sovereignty. Consider that BlackRock's agreement to purchase C.K. Hutchison's non-Chinese port holdings, including the two ports at either end of the Panama Canal, which Trump had hailed as the first step in reclaiming the Panama Canal, is now being scrutinized by Chinese authorities, putting it in limbo and in danger of being canceled. Consider that J.D. and Usha Vance's visit to Greenland, planned to make the U.S. claim, to stake the U.S. claim, was then scaled back to a short visit to the U.S. base there, which had always been there for a long time anyway, during which, moreover, the vice president took pains to deny that the U.S. would use military force. Consider further that in the case of Mexico, the country most vulnerable to Trump's tantrums, President Claudia Sheinbaum will be aided in her difficult struggle to minimize the harm to the Mexican economy by the inflationary effects of tariffs on U.S. prices, their deflationary effect on the U.S. stock market, and the extensive U.S. corporate interests that still rely on close economic relations with Mexico. And finally, consider that even against Venezuela, already battered by a decades-long U.S. regime change operation, there is speculation as to whether the threat to impose 25% additional tariffs on countries, chiefly India and China, buying Venezuelan oil, will be carried out for long, or whether it is just being used as a negotiation strategy. After all, the United States regime change operation in Venezuela has not worked. So with that, our next speaker is Lotte Rørtoft Madsen. Lotte is the chair of the Danish Communist Party. So Lotte, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Radhika. Well, a little week ago, representatives of the US government walked around in Greenland's capital, Nuuk. They were ringing doorbells and knocking on door after door, asking the inhabitants, do you want a visit from the American vice president's wife? Everywhere the answer was the same, no thank you. I start with this small, but in my opinion, significant observation, because it shows very concretely the enormous pressure which the American administration is exercising. And it shows the sentiments of the people of Greenland. As you probably know, the Trump administration had to change their plans on the visit. Several demonstrations were announced in advance. So it ended up with a spectacular visit Friday on the Pituffik Space Base by J.D. Vance. The fact is that in recent months, the almost 57,000 Greenlanders and the large island are being turned into a bargaining chip, a pawn that they are tried to be moved around at will on the great chessboard of imperialism. Trump has repeatedly stated that the US wants the control and to own Greenland, even if necessary by military means. These statements are part of US imperialism's a desperate attempt to maintain its declining political and economic power. And it is, and I agree, a kind of Monroe Doctrine 2.0, where the US controls the Western Hemisphere, or a return to the so-called Manifest Destiny Doctrine, the idea that the US has a fated, God-given duty to expand across the entire North American continent. In his inaugural address, Trump, in fact, referred directly to this doctrine. When it comes to Greenland, the Trump administration and the MAGA movement are now cynically exploiting the desire of the Greenlandic people, the Inuits, for definitively freeing themselves from Danish colonial rule. But just because the Greenlandic people want independence from Danish Empire, this does not mean that they want to instead be colonized by the US Empire. A survey commissioned in January this year showed only 6% of Greenlanders to be in favor of their island becoming part of the US. This sentiment has not changed in recent days. On the contrary, large parts of the Greenlandic population have spoken out openly against the US and Donald Trump. For instance, through a demonstration in Nuuk on March 15, a very big demonstration if you compare to the size of the population. Likewise, the chairman of all five parties elected to the Greenlandic parliament have issued a common statement protesting against the reiterated desire for annexation and control of Greenland from the side of the US. So the opposition to American imperialism is solid. Let me say a few words about Greenland. Well, you know, Greenland is located in the Arctic area, and it is the largest island in the world. It was for centuries a Danish colony, but in 2009, it achieved a so-called self-government agreement. And at that occasion, Denmark officially recognized that the Greenlandic people is a people in its own rights under international law. The self-government status means that the Greenlanders now own the rights to the Greenland subsoil and the minerals and the values found there. But their foreign defense and security policies are decided upon in Denmark. Therefore, Greenland is considered NATO territory. Worth mentioning is also that Greenland is not a member of the European Union. In 1982, the Greenlandic people, through a referendum, voted to leave the European Union. And Greenland today belongs to the EU overseas countries and territories. During and after the years of the World War II, the Danish governments, mainly presided by Social Democrats, through secret agreements, sold out Greenland to American imperialism. The Defense Agreement of 1951 is part of this policy. Thus, the USA has for decades several military facilities in Greenland. And the history of these facilities include forced evictions of Inuit families in 1953, the crash of an American B-52 plane carrying four atomic bombs in 1968, and other detriments to the local population. So why does imperialism want control over Greenland? I think there are two main reasons. Firstly, Greenland's military and security policy geographical position near the Arctic. A militarized and rearmed Greenland is intended to be an advanced base against both Russia and China. Likewise, control of the sea routes to the north, the Northeast Passage, is becoming increasingly important as climate change takes hold. Secondly, Greenland's resource-rich subsurface, especially the existence of rare and strategic earths and minerals. Greenland possesses at least 25 of the 34 minerals which the European Commission has designated as critical raw materials. Rare earths, copper, nickel, zinc, diamonds, iron ore, titanium, you name it, uranium. And Trump wants US companies, many of which have invested heavily in his re-election, to have unfettered access to the Greenlands and to the minerals deposit resources. Besides the prospect of super profits, keeping socialist China far away from Greenland is a strategic goal for both the US and Denmark. What position does Greenland take in this complicated situation? Well, for long now, independence has been on top of the agenda. A procedure for independence from Denmark exists, and a commission has elaborated a draft constitution for an independent Greenland. It is a very progressive draft constitution based on Greenlandic culture, language, and identity. nature and collective rights play a significant role. The draft foresees Greenland to cooperate with other countries to exploit its resources, but not at any cost. It should be done in a way, and I quote, without harming the health of the population and in a responsible manner with regard to safety, the environment, resource utilization, and social sustainability, end of quote. Last year, the former government of Greenland published for the first time ever a foreign defense and security policy strategy. Here, Greenland announces that it intends to take responsibility for a more peaceful world, not only in Greenland. Likewise, Greenland wants to establish trade relations with as many countries as possible so that it doesn't put all eggs in one basket and become vulnerable. The paper names some of the countries with which Greenland will strengthen its trade relations in the coming years, and I quote, China, Japan, Korea, India, United States, Canada, European Union, and the UK. So this is quite another strategy. As you probably know, a new government was formed only hours before the visit of J.D. Vance on Friday. Four parties went into a coalition, a kind of a national coalition government, to defend Greenland in the turmoil it lives. It is too soon to say to what degree it will stand up to the pressure from Washington and Copenhagen. But the new Prime Minister of Greenland put it this way, we have to hurry slowly towards independence. To hurry slowly towards independence. I will end up with some words about the Danish government and its position. In short, the ruling classes of Denmark are interested first and foremost in maintaining good relations with American imperialism. Denmark is not only a founding member of NATO, but also very close to the US-led inner core of Western imperialism today. Now we see an attack being made, not only on the sovereignty of Greenland, but also on the Danish Royal Federation and NATO ally. It is unprecedented, and it asks for the Danish government to defend its people and the Greenlandic people. But let's not be too optimistic about that. On Friday night, the Danish foreign minister delivered a message to the American people. Here he criticized the tone of the Trump administration, the tone. And then he continued, and I quote, we respect that the United States of America needs a greater military presence in Greenland, end of quote.
Great. Thank you so much, Lotte. That's a really important look at not just what's happening in Greenland, but also, of course, the complex position that the government of Denmark finds itself in after decades of support for NATO. Okay, next speaker is Tings Chak. Tings is the Asia coordinator for the Tricontinental Institute. So, Tings, please go ahead.
Thank you, Ratika, and all the fellow panelists, and of course, the Manifesto Group for the invitation. And I'm hoping to share some insights on the situation in Panama, the question of Panamanian sovereignty, and how this relates to U.S.-China relations. So in my time here, I want to divide my talk into three parts. The first is to look at a historical look at the Panama Canal as this symbol of the long and often very violent history of U.S. imperial intervention in Latin America, which, of course, as other speakers have noted, is rooted in this 200 years of the Monroe Doctrine. And the second part I want to look at is the aggressions, of course, of the Trump administration as a continuation of this history, reborn in this moment, which is a context of the U.S.'s new Cold War against China. And the third part, I'll just highlight some of the positions of China historically and today, and its alignment with the people, Panamanian people's struggle for sovereignty and national dignity that spans over six decades. So maybe just to begin with, I think that Panama's very existence as an independent nation is very closely tied with the Monroe Doctrine itself. And while Panama did declare independence from Colombia in 1804, it wasn't until a century later, in 1903, that it actually became an independent state. And that only happened because of direct U.S. intervention. And I'll just go into a bit briefly, is that at the time, Panama was caught up in a civil war known as the War of 1,000 Days between Colombian elites and factions within Panama. Initially, the U.S. had intervened to actually help suppress the rebellion. But when Colombia refused to grant the U.S. rights to build the canal, which, of course, is at the center of attention today, Washington very quickly changed its course and backed the Panamanian side instead. And it was very much part of the U.S. gunboat diplomacy, sending gunboats in, literally, that Panama declared its independence with the full military support of U.S. And interestingly, this independence came at a cost, of course. Just 15 days later, a treaty was signed that gave the U.S. exclusive and permanent rights to build, manage, and militarily control the Panama Canal Zone, and really set to precedent a really model for this U.S. gunboat diplomacy throughout the Americas, and opened up a series of future interventions. And we've seen from Cuba to Nicaragua to Haiti to Mexico and beyond. And so throughout the 20th century, the Panama Canal not only became an economic lifeline, but also an important symbol of this foreign domination. And of course, with that came popular demands for sovereignty, especially amongst the youth. And this came to a head in January of 1964, when many of the students in Panama tried to raise this sort of national, actually literally a national flag in the canal zone. And what they were met with was extreme repression by U.S. forces, local police, and several students were injured and killed. It was a massacre. And this kind of sparked a wave of a variety of, you know, national protests, amongst other things. And the turning point really came when the General Omar Torrijos overthrew this pro-U.S. oligarchy and began implementing a series of progressive reforms and really positioning this fight for Panamanian sovereignty as a key banner of his administration. And he began basically what became a series of negotiations with the U.S. Carter administration to ensure that the canal would eventually be transferred back to Panamanian control, a process that took 20 years from 1979 to 1999 when it was finally completed. And so I'm just saying all this to understand that the history of the Panama Canal has been a history around U.S. imperialist interests in the region. So it's not surprising when Donald Trump came into his second term, his inauguration speech mentions Panama Canal, and it's the only time that actually China was mentioned in relation to the canal. And he had said that it was foolishly given away to the Panaman people. And he had said several times, we've heard many speeches, that were so-called taking it back. And so I think, like we heard from the previous speaker around Greenland and other places, it's very much part of this expansionist ambitions that has characterized this first period of Trump's 2.0, whether it's allies of Greenland, Canada, and aggressions in Mexico and others and beyond. So the Panama Canal is very much part of this. And to kind of put into motion this vision was, of course, Marco Rubio, who in his first international trip as the Secretary of State, he visited Panama and warned very ominously the Panamanian president, Mulino, that immediate changes had to be made to reduce Chinese influence over the canal or, and I quote, the U.S. would take necessary measures. And I think what we've seen is that despite, you know, the Panamanian government making, you know, some initial sort of strong stances, actually made a series of concessions after this visit. The first thing we saw was that it ended its participation in China's Belt and Road Initiative. It agreed to share intelligence with the U.S. and a series of other concessions that we're seeing specifically right now on CK Hutchinson, which is a Hong Kong-based company that has been basically running several ports, including two sides of the Panamanian port, since 1997. And maybe I'll just mention a little bit, because I think it's important and it's interesting, the players that are actually involved in the situation. It's actually the infamous BlackRock right now that is currently in the process of trying to buy 43 ports from Hutchinson for $22 billion, including the very, very key ports. That's Balboa and Cristobal, which is responsible for almost 40% of the cargo containers passing through the Panama Canal. Of course, both Trump and Rubio were briefed by BlackRock's billionaire chief executive, Larry Fink. We're going to see the results coming out in 2 days. It's been very hot and topic in the news, and we're going to have to see what comes up of that. But one thing we're seeing is that BlackRock is very much pushing into an arena that has been an arena where China has been a big player, which is infrastructure. Last year, it bought the Global Infrastructure Partners and is very much in a collision course in terms of China's interests. So if this deal goes through, it could be very much a leverage for the Trump administration to sort of flip the script, making Latin American and Caribbean countries more active to pursue U.S. private sectors to compete in this very critical and strategic sector, which is port infrastructure, amongst other kinds of infrastructural projects. And so it's not just about a question of, you know, diplomatic or economic maneuvers or pressures. This is very much coming with a strong military presence. What we have seen is that one of the outcomes of Rubio's visit is that there's been agreement to have U.S. military involvement in the Darien jungle region and a possible airstrip to be installed in that area. In addition to this, we've been hearing quite a lot of rumors or reports around possible U.S. military bases returning to Panama on the pretense of certain humanitarian missions. We're seeing reports about the U.S. military Southern Command considering options, including, and I quote, taking the canal by force. And so I think what we also have to recognize is that many of the progressive and left and popular leaders have actually come together in Panama to really denounce these actions. And they came together with a declaration recently. And the first point, amongst other demands, is outright rejection of foreign intervention and militarization, and a very strong opposition to this U.S. interference and Trump's attempts to retake control of the Panama Canal, its adjacent ports, and establish military bases. And I think that's really important for us to elevate the voices of the Panamanian people that are resisting this kind of aggression. And just to kind of wrap up a little bit, I wanted to talk about, I think, China's relationship, especially the People's Republic of China, with Panama. There's been a long history of solidarity, but interestingly, it's only in 2017 where Panama officially recognized the PRC and cut ties with Taiwan, being amongst the last 20 countries in the world with diplomatic ties with Taiwan. And it was very quickly, shortly thereafter, that Panama joined the Belt and Road Initiative. Chinese companies began to invest heavily in terms of bridges, ports, and other logistical infrastructure. And we've been seeing in the recent years, China has been deepening its ties with Latin America and the Caribbean. It has already replaced the U.S. as South America's top trading partner. While what we're seeing in response, without really an ability to react in a concrete or constructive way to China's increasing influence in the region, what has been the U.S.'s response? More threats of sanctions, annexations, and sometimes even very underwhelming responses. I think one of the things we saw recently was the announcement of the $3.5 billion Chiang Kai port in Peru, built by Chinese companies with Chinese investments, et cetera. Very shortly after that was announced or unveiled, what did we see? We had Anthony Blinken announcing a so-called donation of these used passenger trains from California. And it was a kind of a PR failure completely, you know, to kind of compare the kinds of investments and projects that China is really putting in the region. And maybe I'll just end with something to take us back to this long history of solidarity. And it's something to do in 1964, when I'd mentioned this massacre of Panamanian students in the Canal Zone. At the time, 20 million Chinese people across the country actually protested, 20 million people in support of Panama's sovereignty. And Chairman Mao Zedong issued a formal statement which was published widely across the country. And I'm going to quote him because I think it's still very relevant to our day. And he said, and I quote, "The heroic struggle now being waged by the people of Panama against U.S. aggression and in defense of their national sovereignty is a great and patriotic struggle. The Chinese people stand firmly on the side of the Panamanian people and fully support their just action in opposing the U.S. aggressors and seeking to regain sovereignty over the Panama Canal Zone. U.S. imperialism is the most ferocious enemy of the people of the world." And so I think we can see 61 years later, Panama Canal once again is at the center of this U.S. imperial dominance as a part of this reassertion of the Monroe Doctrine. And I think these words from Mao Zedong might be quite, you know, still resonate and still hold true for us. I just wanted to end with this picture that I had found in the archives of some of the protests and the solidarity messages from the Chinese people, which I think are still true today. Here's another picture of the massive protests that happened in the Tiananmen Square. And some of the slogans of that time, 61 years ago, when they were saying firm support of the struggle of the Panamanian people to recover the canal. They said, Panama, yes, Yankees, no. And this really filled the streets and the airwaves. I think that today the demands very much resonate as the people of Panama firmly defend their sovereignty in the face of the U.S.'s new wave of aggressions in the region. So thank you very much.
Great. Thanks so much, Dings. That was absolutely wonderful and very informative and thought-provoking. So thanks very much. We now go to our fourth speaker. Our fourth speaker is Dimitri Lascaris. Dimitri is a very prominent lawyer, former important leader of the Green Party of Canada, and a journalist based in Canada and in Greece. So Dimitri, please go ahead.
It's a pleasure to be here with all of you today. When I was asked to participate in this excellent discussion, I started by inquiring into the conventional meaning of the Monroe Doctrine. And to answer this question, I consulted the United States National Archives, because after all, it is in the bowels of the U.S. government that the Monroe Doctrine was initially conceived. And according to an 8-paragraph summary of the doctrine contained in the U.S. National Archives, the doctrine was, as Radhika mentioned at the outset, first articulated by President James Monroe in his 7th annual message to Congress on December 2nd, 1823, over 200 years ago. And the European powers, according to Monroe, were obligated to respect the Western Hemisphere as the United States' sphere of interest. According to the National Archives, Monroe warned European nations that the United States would not tolerate further colonization or puppet monarchs in the Western Hemisphere. The National Archives goes on to state that as late as 1962, the Monroe Doctrine was invoked when the Soviet Union began to build missile launching sites in Cuba. So, as framed at the time of its initial articulation, it sounded like an anti-colonial doctrine. That's the way it was presented to the world, and one which was designed to ensure the independence and sovereignty of states in the Western Hemisphere. Now, a few points I want to make about this articulation of the doctrine. First, the Western Hemisphere is generally understood to mean the Americas and the westernmost parts of Europe and Africa. It encompasses, of course, half the planet and is obviously a vast space. According to the conventional understanding of the Monroe Doctrine, the doctrine encompasses Argentina and Chile, whose capitals are more than 8,000 kilometers from Washington. That is further than the distance between Washington and major European capitals such as Berlin and Rome. No one who defends this doctrine has ever explained the logic of including such distant countries in America's sphere of influence. At any rate, it is clear the doctrine clearly extends far beyond the countries bordering on the United States. And I think one of the common misconceptions is that it is intended to defend the United States from threats on its borders or near its borders. That's clearly not true. Second, the National Archives explains that the doctrine was intended to preclude the further colonization of the Western Hemisphere, as I mentioned, by European powers, and the installation in the Western Hemisphere of puppet monarchs. However, what if a non-Western power such as China does not seek to colonize or install a puppet in a country of the Western Hemisphere, but simply engages in mutually beneficial commercial relations with such a country? Would the Monroe Doctrine be applied to such a relationship? Well, I think that Trump has clearly provided the answer to that question. China, as one of our colleagues just explained, is engaged in mutually beneficial commercial relations with the country of Panama. And the United States has objected vociferously to that, even though no one could plausibly argue that the government of Panama is a puppet of the People's Republic of China. In fact, if anything, it is a puppet of the United States and has long proven itself to be a puppet of the United States. Now, another point I wish to make is that the Monroe Doctrine never really went away. The peoples of the Western Hemisphere have had to deal with it continuously since the time of its first articulation more than 200 years ago. Some of you may recall that former U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told the Organization of American States in November 2013 that the era of the Monroe Doctrine is over. But a mere 3 years later, Donald Trump came to power. In 2017, he implied that the doctrine remained enforced when he raised the possibility of military intervention in Venezuela. And as we all know, the first Trump administration imposed harsh sanctions against both Venezuela and Cuba, even though neither of them posed the remotest threat to the security of the United States, and neither of them could be plausibly argued to be a puppet of any non-Western power. These two examples highlight the examples of Venezuela and Cuba, another aspect of the Monroe Doctrine that is poorly understood. The doctrine does not exist simply to nullify threats to U.S. security. In practice, it has been used, in fact, to enforce servitude to Washington. Washington has never had a problem with puppets in the Western Hemisphere as long as the puppets belong to Washington. In fact, the Monroe Doctrine has been applied again and again to punish governments in the Western Hemisphere, like Venezuela and Cuba, that refuse to act as vassals of the United States, even when those governments are not vassals of any non-Western power. Interestingly, in 1902, Canadian Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier stated that the Monroe Doctrine was essential to Canada's protection. The doctrine, he claimed, provided Canada with a de facto security guarantee by the United States. Wilfrid Laurier sounded like, you know, a local capo who is paying fealty to the Don, the Godfather, in Washington. Laurier promoted the misconception that the Monroe Doctrine is designed simply to preclude the domination of Western states by non-Western powers, but as I mentioned, that is plainly false. Nowhere is this more obvious than in Canada today. Canadian foreign policy is almost a carbon copy of U.S. foreign policy and has been for decades. Through the auspices of NATO, NORAD, and the Five Eyes, Canada serves the interests of Washington in the military and intelligence spheres. Economically, Canada is more dependent on the United States than any other country by far. In short, Canada has become a vassal to the U.S., even in the cultural sphere. And now the chickens are coming home to roost. And because Canada has allowed itself to be placed in a position of fealty and dependence to the United States through its embrace of the Monroe Doctrine, it is extraordinarily vulnerable to economic and military threats to the United States. A final preliminary point I wish to make about the doctrine is that it does not preclude U.S. imperialism in the non-Western world. So it's not reciprocal. On the contrary, throughout the post-World War II period, the U.S. government has engaged in ruthless imperialism throughout the non-Western world, and including, of course, in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, West Asia, and Eastern Africa, amongst other areas of the world. In other words, since the doctrine was articulated, there has never been a time when the U.S. government acted as if it was obliged to refrain from colonizing or installing puppets in nations of the non-Western world. And this was true even during the Soviet era. One could argue, in fact, that in the post-World War II era, the U.S. government has applied the Monroe Doctrine to the entire planet and not just the Western Hemisphere. In a way, I regard the Monroe Doctrine as a distraction. It means little more than U.S. imperialism in the Western Hemisphere. And in our lifetimes, U.S. imperialism was never confined to the Western Hemisphere. Its scope has always, in the post-World War II period, been global. The Monroe Doctrine is simply a way of making U.S. imperialism seem more palatable in the Western Hemisphere by casting it as a defense from the encroachment on the sovereignty of Western powers by non-Western states. And finally, I want to say just a few words about Russia's interesting response to Trump's attempt to confiscate Greenland. A few days ago, speaking from the Arctic, Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Washington's ambitions for the Arctic nation are serious. He went on and he said, quote, "These plans have deep historical roots, and it's clear that the U.S. will continue to systematically pursue its geostrategic, military, political, and economic interests in the Arctic. As for Greenland, this is a matter for two specific countries. It has nothing to do with us." I'm interested in the thoughts of others in this conversation about why Putin made that statement and what it means. Personally, I don't really think it amounts to anything, because if the United States were to move militarily on Greenland, and who knows, Trump is perfectly capable of such a thing, direct intervention by the Russian Federation would almost certainly precipitate a nuclear war. If this matter were to come up for a vote at the UN Security Council, I have no doubt that both the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China would object vociferously to this brazen violation of the United States' obligations under the United Nations Charter. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Dmitry. Again, another really rich presentation. Our final speaker is Carlos Ron. Carlos Ron is the former Vice Minister for Foreign Affairs responsible for North America of Venezuela.
Well, thank you, Radhika, and everybody. It's a pleasure to be here with you. First of all, I think to this question about the Monroe Doctrine, whether it's still in use, I think it's something that it has not gone away, despite the fact that during the Obama administration, there was a moment when John Kerry said, oh, we're burying the Monroe Doctrine. Then pretty soon, John Bolton brought it back up and, you know, this Monroe 2.0. And from there on, it's never gone away. And I think it brings us to discuss or to think about, to reflect on the fact that the Monroe Doctrine really represents the contradiction between two projects in the region of the Americas. And it's a project of manifest destiny, of expansionism on behalf of the United States, as well, or in confrontation with a project of unity, of sovereignty, and of dignity, which is the Bolivarian project that was formed during the independence movement in a region, and particularly in Venezuela. And I say this because I think it's important for us to understand that this is not something that starts with Monroe in 1823, but it actually is part of the roots of U.S. exceptionalism, of this notion that the U.S. has some sort of right to expand its borders until it reached the rest of the countries of Latin America. And we always quote this letter from Thomas Jefferson, which is dated in 1786, way before the Monroe Doctrine, where Jefferson says, and I quote, "Our Confederacy must be viewed as the nest from which all America, North and South, is to be peopled. We should take care to not think it for the interests of that great continent to press too soon on the Spaniards." This, by the way, is the moment where there were some demands for the U.S. to get involved and to support the liberation movements in South America. But Jefferson here rejects this notion and says, "Those countries cannot be in better hands, the hands of Spain. My fear is that they are too feeble to hold them till our population can be sufficiently advanced to gain it from them piece by piece." This is way before the Monroe Doctrine, and this shows exactly that they already perceived our region, our countries, as an extension. They feel that they have these inherent rights. And right now, in the year 2025, it's still sort of the same feeling, the same type of imposition. And when you look at the evolution of the Monroe Doctrine, I mean, there's been different corollaries. There was a discourse, so one of our conversations at the beginning, you know, there was this discourse of some sort of anti-colonial feeling, you know, they sort of tried to mask the expansionism with some sort of attempts to defend Latin America. But when you know, the years go by, you see every year or every corollary is even more incisive, it's even more interventionist. You know, you get to the point where the United States decides that if there's a country in debt in the region, then the United States has a right to intervene and force the country to pay its debt. If there's some controversy with other countries, the United States has like a debt or any other type of tension with a European power, the United States has the right to intervene and stop that. So every year it starts getting ever more and more interventionist. And then the story of the 20th century, we've seen it very clearly. It was a story of coup d'etats, a story of military intervention, occupation, taking over of the ports, taking over of the customs of Dominican Republic, for example. There's a whole series of military, especially military actions that take place during the 21st century. What we shouldn't lose sight of is that in the 21st century, the Monroe Doctrine has new forms of expression. And just to name a few that I think are important that we often lose track of because we're still thinking of the framework of the 20th century with the military type of interventions. But there's the intervention under the banner of humanitarian aid through NGOs. Of course, now USAID has undergone these changes under this administration, but look at the role it was playing under the mask of NGOs. It was also having specific types of intervention, creating more dependence of the region towards the United States. There's intervention through religious fundamentalism, you know, religions that were created by the CIA in a form of a response towards liberation theology, which was promoting a different type of view of religion or of society in itself that was anti-imperialist. It's the expansion through fake news, through communications, and the dominance that the United States still has in this arena, now even more through social media. But also, of course, the dominance or the interventionism through the use of unilateral coercive measures. And here, Venezuela is one of the prime examples, but also Cuba that has been blockaded for over 60 years. You know, it's this idea that in a way it's somehow more humane than a military intervention because you're not, you know, shooting bullets, but the effects that these coercive measures can have are as dangerous and are as serious as any other type of war. So in the middle of this new moment of imperialism, this what we call hyper-imperialism, where there's need for the United States to overcome the loss of its hegemony to its competitors, to who it believes is the competitors in China and Russia. Well, war, once again, is the driving force, and military expansion and military presence is part of this. And we see it expressed in the traditional sense of the meaning of the world war, but also in the growing expansionism that strategically is telling the U.S. to go and try to, you know, step up in Panama, to step up in Greenland, to, you know, have more presence in other parts of the regions, to consolidate its military and political dominance over the hemisphere when it sees that China and other countries that it doesn't like is trying to or is achieving more influence. In the particular case of Venezuela, I would have to say that we're facing three specific attacks right now. Of course, we all know about the U.S. coercive measures on oil production in Venezuela. This is very hurtful for the country when it's, of course, one of its main sources of income. It's been so historically. So we went back to the maximum pressure campaign of the first Trump administration, reducing the span of the licenses, especially the Chevron license, that allowed some Venezuelan oil production to pick up in the last couple of years during the Biden administration. But we have to understand that, you know, this tactic of using licenses is also part of the aggression. You know, we shouldn't need a license. We shouldn't be having sanctions in the first place. It wasn't something positive that was given to us through the Biden administration. And I want to make this point because I think we have to understand that the Monroe Doctrine and that U.S. imperialism is bipartisan. It's not because of Trump right now. It's not, you know, it's going to get worse. It's part of a systemic ideology of U.S. policy. It doesn't matter what the party in government is. It's always going to have this expansionist vision, and it's always going to try to have this aggression on Venezuela. Recently, it was announced not only that the Chevron license was going to be terminated, even though it got expanded on one more month, and, you know, of course, we'll still have to see when the day comes how this develops. But then, you know, this threat of adding 25% tariffs on anyone that does business with Venezuelan oil as part of an aggression. It's an attack on free commerce. It's an attack on Venezuela's sovereignty. And it's been, of course, part of the attempt at overthrowing the Venezuelan government by reducing its capacity of its economy, by reducing its income. But now we are faced with another part of aggression against Venezuela, and it's an aggression against the Venezuelan people in particular. It's aggression against Venezuelan migrants who are in the U.S. using a law that, you know, is dated from 1798 and, you know, is criminalizing Venezuelans. It got to the point where it's sending Venezuelans to jail in El Salvador because as there are no diplomatic relations between the two countries, there could be no direct deportations to Venezuela. So they decided to invoke this law to send Venezuelans out into El Salvador, basically being kidnapped and even forced into labor in these detention centers in El Salvador in a measure that is completely illegal, that has no legal basis. When you're supposed to use this law or invoke this law during a time of war, and Venezuela is not at war with the United States, but it's a consideration that the administration, the current administration, wants to interpret as if there was some sort of attack, as if there was some attempt against the United States on behalf of Venezuela. It's an excuse, it's outrageous, and Venezuela is doing everything it can to combat this aggression in international courts. President Maduro has spoken to the Secretary General of the UN, to the UN's Human Rights Council, all these institutions that, you know, are very fast criticizing Venezuela when the US pressures them to do so, are having very quiet in general terms when they have to, you know, approach something as terrible, as horrific as what these families are feeling when you have people that just because they have a tattoo or, you know, some mark, they're being condemned as if they're criminals with no due process, and they're being thrown in jails in a country where their families can't even reach them or can even try to have some defense. And finally, the third attack, which I think is very important that we also consider, and that is also an exception of the Monroe Doctrine, is the attack on Venezuela because of the region of the Guayana Esequiba, which is a historical territorial claim that Venezuela has on a disputed land controversy in the border between the countries of Venezuela and Guyana. Now, of course, I can't get into the details of the historical claim, but I want to make sure that the people understand something and the roots of this issue. There was a treaty signed in 1899 where basically this issue begins, and Venezuela has contested the validity of that agreement. And in 1966, there was another agreement, the Geneva Agreement, where it recognized that there was a controversy that had to be brought to a solution through diplomatic means by the agreement of the two countries. Since 1966 until at least 2015, we hadn't solved the issue, but we were looking for solutions through diplomatic channels. What changed drastically was that in 2015, ExxonMobil gets into this territory, especially in the waters, which cannot be determined if they belong to either country until the land border is drawn. And they start exploring, and they try to extract oil from this region, which is under dispute. Exxon has exerted tremendous pressure. Exxon's president became then the first Secretary of State of President Trump, and the pressure that the company was exerting became now the pressure of the State Department. And now there's this presence, not only of ExxonMobil, in places that we consider illegal because of this is in this disputed land, but also they're being backed by the U.S. Navy, by Southcom, by the CIA, and even by Marco Rubio, who just last week was in Guyana and said that if Venezuela threatened, which Venezuela has never threatened any military action, but if Venezuela threatened or did something to Guyana, it would be a very bad day. So we are being threatened by that statement. I think this is very important because when you realize that the goal here has always been to overthrow the Venezuelan government, to derail its socialist process, to take control of Venezuelan resources and specifically Venezuela's oil, you see that all these elements, the three I just mentioned, sort of add up. It's an attack against the government. It's an attack against Venezuelan institutions, against the Venezuelan state. And it's part of that Monroe Doctrine that believes that Venezuela is some sort of extension of the United States and should be under its control. I think it's important to say the Venezuelan people and the Venezuelan government have always stood tall against this aggression. We have stood our ground. We are not going to cede at any point because we believe that we have the right to determine our own future and build our own future of prosperity, of peace, of socialism. But this aggression is currently here, and this aggression must be visualized by everyone who's trying to analyze this moment in Latin America. Monroe Doctrine is very alive under the Trump administration, and the Bolivarian Doctrine is also very alive. And because of that, we're going to confront it, we're going to resist, and as we have done in the past, we will overcome and we will succeed. Thank you very much.